You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. Yes, I'm overseas at the moment, but I'm Richard McCall reporting in for Colombia Calling. And this is episode 184 of our little podcast talking about all things Colombia. And in a very interesting situation here, I have got author and academic Robert A. Carl on the line from Boston, Massachusetts, and we're talking about his new book focused on a very important area of Colombian history. It's just out. It's called Forgotten Peace, and I've read the whole book, and I find it fascinating. It's a very, very profoundly investigated historical, I would say almost historical, narrative, because it tells the story of some of the most conflicting times in Colombian politics, but through a different lens, I think. I think it's very interesting indeed. So basically, rather than talk more nonsense, I'm going to keep Rob on the line here to talk about the book. And well, let's start from the very beginning. Rob, welcome on Colombia Calling.
Richard, thank you so much for reading the book and for the opportunity to speak with you this morning.
You're most welcome. So welcome on Colombia Calling. And listen, just tell us a little bit how you came to be an expert in Colombia and how this book came about.
Yeah, so I have always been interested in Latin American history in the 1960s, above all, questions of development, questions of security, counterinsurgency. As I write in the book's acknowledgments, I did a semester study abroad program with my undergraduate history degree in London, and I left the night of September 10th, 2001. Mm. So I developed, I think, a different take on the ways in which U.S. power is projected abroad. And when I got to graduate school, that interest in the 60s ultimately landed me in Colombia. My graduate advisor taught a seminar in Colombia for the first time. I think one thing now that I'm reflecting is really this book is the result of extraordinary timing. So my advisor, been teaching for decades, offers a course on Colombia for the first time just as I get to graduate school. The book comes out just as the peace process with the FARC wraps up. It's really extraordinary. So I was drawn to Colombia, like the rest of the country's history, but then was also extremely fortunate for a young historian in that I found exactly the archives I needed to write the story that I wanted to write. And from that sort of interest in the ways in which U.S. power is projected overseas, I got increasingly drawn deeper and deeper into the Colombian countryside as a subject.
Fascinating indeed. So, and you know, so as I read your notes and so on, you had been studying sort of other parts of the world, but Colombia really caught your attention, as you suggest. And therefore, I mean, I imagine that was it. Travel to Colombia had to come about, and investigation, and of course, then getting all of these theses approved by your various tutors.
Yes. No. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I made the decision to start studying Colombia in 2005. That was the 2005. So that was the year of my first trip, and had to overcome a bit of reluctancy, certainly on the part of members of my family, maybe less on my advisors on traveling to the country for the first time.
Yeah. So you were down, but 2004, 2005, Colombia was a different country to the one it is today. Uribe was in power, I guess.
Yes. So I spent my longest stretch in Colombia, I think, just before you got there. So yeah. It's 2006, 2007. Yeah. So I arrived just a few weeks before Uribe's second inauguration.
Yeah. So
before 2006.
Before the second inauguration where it was bombed by the FARC, or was it the first one? I can't recall.
I can't recall either. I think it was the second.
Yeah, I think it was second the second one. I think it was the second one too. When they fired the sort of grenades from the Parque Tercer Milenio.
Yeah, which I would later walk through to get to the archive every day.
That's right. Then now the archives is a fascinating building. I've been in there several times trying to do some investigations and found it incredibly difficult to find what I'm looking for. So when I saw your sort of acknowledgements to the people at the archives, I can understand that they probably worked quite hard to help you out too.
Yes, absolutely. I owe them a tremendous debt, and I really, again, lucky that I was one of the first historian to work through these records from the 1950s and 60s systematically.
Excellent. So now let's move on to your book, and let's talk a little bit about its relationship to the political situation today in Colombia, because I read the book and it reads incredibly well. Let's just say that for starters, and it would be a great book for people looking to understand some of the platforms of the political discord that we see today, and of course dating back to this sort of the 1950s and 1960s, and you focus on one area, sort of, let's say, known as Gran Tolima, Greater Tolima, so of course just outside of Bogota. And imagine you had to spend a significant amount of time down there and into Onda and then beyond. But so why did you decide to focus on Tolima, let's say?
Right. So as part of this interest in the 1960s, I think like a lot of people, I was drawn to the FARC as a subject. So the dissertation, to some extent, that my book is based on, and certainly the book, are in large part an origin story of the FARC. Mm-hmm. And so, well, the themes that I look at around violence and peace and development are very important in other regions of the country. It's sort of this region that tells us the most about major themes, sort of major directions in the country's history in the succeeding decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm going to pull a quote that you quote in your book about Tolima, and it's one of, said by a British diplomat in 1958. It says, "Tolima represents in many respects and in accentuated form an amalgam of the troubles and problems which affect Colombia as a whole." And I found that obviously as concise and effective quote as any to describe this. And I know that you listened to my recent podcast about the time I spent down in Guaviare. I've always seen Guaviare now as the like melting pot for today's problems. I think Tolima perhaps represents, perhaps, you know, it has moved on a bit from the sort of 1950s, but I now see Guaviare as that complete perfect crossroads of the conflict there. So it's very interesting that these sort of flashpoints tend to occur in Colombia.
I think one of the ways we could explain that is one of the most important themes in Colombian history, which is this internal agrarian frontier. So we're not talking about border areas with, you know, Venezuela or Brazil, but sort of unsettled lands that are people haven't been given private title. They're still state-owned lands. So you've got small agriculturalists and then sort of larger landowners moving in after them who seek to establish some sort of livelihood for themselves growing. You know, in the 19th century, you might have just had sort of basic cash crops. But then increasingly coffee. And then as we get into the 20th century, it's coca. Yeah. One of the major symbols of Colombia, and it's more a regional symbol that stands in for the national, and I don't write about this in the book, but Juan Valdez, the symbol of the Colombian coffee grower, comes out actually in the late 1950s, so at this precise moment that I'm writing about. So, you know, this frontier settler with the single man and his mule just growing coffee. What we see later in the 20th century and into the 21st is sort of the Juan Valdez de la Coca, right? So this small small proprietary farmer who's now growing a different cash crop, which carries a lot of, you know, different implications for his relation with his neighbors and with the state, with markets, and so on. So yes, Tolima still has a great, and Gran Tolima as a whole, have a lot of these internal frontier areas, but I think you're right that the sort of epicenter of a lot of these conflicts and themes has moved out to the eastern part of the country.
It's so fascinating to think that, and I think that obviously a lot of this has to do with the internal displacement. And again, this is a huge a huge, let's say, theme within your book, and you do, and it's an amazing to see it, because that's why I want to recommend people to this, is this internal displacement, which is referred to as internal migration at this time, I think, in a lot of cases. And I think Colombians sometimes get this romantic, sort of feeling of, oh, the migration of the colonos towards other areas, you know. But as you have in your book, it's the displacement and the violence was occurring for so many years before when we, you know, in contemporary days, it seemed, or in the press, seem to put the Colombian conflict as having begun. Sort of, it's always an inverted commas, 1964, the FARC. But you've got this great paragraph, which I've got here. It says, on the basis of surveys carried out in 1957, Tolima officials stated that more than 320,000 people, that's fully 42% of the department's residents, had experienced displacement between 1949 and 1957. So we were even taking, you know, almost two decades prior to when it's officially sort of ticked off. And I think that's what's so very important. We come in to a state of, let's say, Cold War inspired conflict in 1964, but it's begun far before that. And you go into this and properties are abandoned and people are motivated by fear and political violence. Are there any figures that tell us about, sort of, let's say, how many people may have lost their lives in the area of Tolima in this situation?
No, that's a great question. So let's maybe step back and get to broader historical context. So the period between roughly 1946 and, it's often cited, to the mid-1960s, as a lot of your listeners will have heard, is known as La Violencia, the violence, capital L, capital V. So this period of, often cited as violence, between the historic liberal and conservative parties that then mutates in the mid-1960s and, as you say, this Cold War conflict. Mm-hmm. That's the standard narrative. Mm-hmm. The standard statistics that get cited is that around 200,000 Colombians lost their lives over these two decades. Mm-hmm. The most commonly cited statistics also say that about 2 million Colombians, this is in a country of about 14 million. Mm-hmm. So levels of displacement similar, if not higher, to what Colombia has witnessed since the mid-1980s, when we know it as having one of the highest populations of internally displaced peoples in the world. So what my book tries to do is actually push back against some of those assumptions, or at least look at the way in which those narratives about the country's mid-century history are constructed.
Right.
So the title of the book is Forgotten Peace. Mm-hmm. So it looks at this period in the late 50s through mid-60s, as a period of really serious experimentation with different forms of peacemaking and development projects, and time in which Colombians really treated the conflict of the prior decade as having come to an end. And it's only through their disillusionment with politics and development with the peace process by the late 1960s that you've got violence read back over the period. This idea we have of La Violencia with capital letters as the mid-1940s to the mid-1960s comes into being. So there's a lot of debate in the late 1950s as the peace process begins, precisely to the question that you asked, you know, how many people have been killed or displaced in Gran Tolima? And it's actually one of the remarkable things, that number of 200,000 fatalities that we see cited in social, professional, scholarly social science literature since the late 1970s, we can see a very similar number actually in the late 1950s into the early 1960s. So, you know, I actually think that number might be a little high, but it's interesting to see the ways in which it sort of pops up and is reinforced again and again over the past five plus decades.
I mean, I'm truly fascinating, because it's something that's, it's overlooked. It's, again, like you said, it sort of pops up in maybe more writings by Alfredo Molano or someone like that, you know, someone who does the legwork through the regions and actually sits down and talks to people. And I just find it so very interesting. As you say, it's this sort of era where they sort of say that La Violencia is, I guess, it's petering out, and there's this disdain for the politics and this despair. And, you know, let's not get into it into this section, because we're winding down this first segment. But I think we can see so much of what was going on then also occurring now in this term of this real just lack of confidence in the ruling political classes. And I think that's something to explore.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And I think, if I may, one of the differences we see between the peace process today and the peace process that took place in the 1950s is that in the late 1950s, as the National Front coalition between the liberals and conservatives is coming into being, the country's also exiting a period of authoritarian rule that's mm-hmm. lasted for roughly a decade. Mm-hmm. So I make comparisons in the book between what happens in Colombia in the late 1950s and what we see around truth commissions, national reconciliation, transitional justice regimes in the better known Latin American cases in the 1980s and 90s, around, you know, Argentina, Chile, Brazil to a lesser extent, Guatemala. Those processes of, again, truth-telling, reconciliation are happening within the context of a democratic transition. That's mm-hmm. not happening today. So I think the kind of disillusionment with the political, with the ruling class that we see today, and as you said, it certainly has its historical antecedents, that was lessened a little bit by the what I describe in the book as sort of these optimistic politics of democratic transition that mm-hmm. transpire. Mm-hmm. So Santos today doesn't have the benefit of that broader political context. In some ways, he's starting from a step or two behind where, if we're going to make the historical comparison, you know, his predecessors in the presidency started in the late 50s and early 60s.
Very interesting indeed. So we're going to take a short break, but let me say again, we're talking to Robert A. Carl, who's the assistant professor of history at Princeton University, and we're talking about his newly published book, Forgotten Peace, where he focuses on an area after La Violencia and before, let's say, even more contemporary Colombia. And an excellent book if you want to get further into the crux of Colombian politics and to, of course, learn why things have developed the way they have. So we'll be taking a short break and we'll be right back to talk further about Rob's book, Forgotten Peace, and about Colombia, of course. So don't go away. Please stay listening. Thank you. And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall here on the line to Robert A. Carl, who's an assistant professor of history from Princeton University. And we're talking about his book, Forgotten Peace. And we're talking about, you know, how the politics of then, the 1950s, Gran Tolima in specific case, the reference that is made in Rob's book all the way through. That's the basically the example he takes. But we're talking about that. And we're talking about how it reflects on politics today and today in Colombia. And I read the book, Rob, and what I liked most is that the reference is just to people who I'd never heard about. I consider myself relatively versed in Colombian history, not, of course, an assistant professor or anything, but I try and do my research and so on and so forth. And this name pops up, Lord Parga. I need you to explain to my listeners a little bit who he is, because there are no lords in Colombia, there are lords, but they're not named lords.
Right. Well, this is sort of generally Colombia still today, as you know, but certainly in the 1950s and 60s, it was a very small place in a lot of ways. So as I was turning the dissertation into a book, trying to make it more narrative, these characters just kept popping up, and I learned that if you sort of follow the threads and pay attention to the names, you're going to come across these characters who just come up again and again and really can form the spine of a nice story. So Lord Parga was a Colombian who was actually born in England. Mm-hmm. His father was head of one of the big Colombian banks over there, so I don't remember exactly how long. I think he went to Oxford, Parga did, and then, you know, comes to Colombia as an adult. He had never been there before. So he, his entire life, he mm-hmm. spoke with a very strong British accent. So I'm looking for the quote right now. But he's a member of the Liberal Party and
really?
Plays a role. Yes, he plays a role in the peacemaking of the late 1950s. So mm-hmm. he's actually on the cover of my book, this really beautiful photograph of him with the eventual founders of the FARC, in I think September 1957, so a few months into this democratic transition, this sort of a peace, this, these peacemaking experiments are getting underway. So he's going out to the countryside, getting helicoptered out to meet with these communist and liberal leaders of the armed struggle from the 1950s. So there's a really wonderful quote from the also colorfully named Peligro, or Danger, one of these liberal commanders, who said, told an interviewer later, and here I'm quoting, "We accepted Paredes' proposal for peace, despite sometimes not being able to understand the language he spoke." So a lot of the book is framed, my book is framed around encounters between urban and rural Colombians. And other historians, particularly Tycho Brahe, have written really wonderfully about the cultural divide that exists between the countryside and the cities. This is also something we see referenced directly in the peace accord between the government and the FARC. But this is just a comical sort of very overstated example of that cultural divide.
I think it's phenomenal. I'm kind of getting this idea. I realize that he's Colombian, but born in England and obviously schooled at the finest schools, and then goes to Oxford, just in the great tradition of elitism and privilege and entitlement, I suppose. But he's over in Colombia as a Colombian. They can't understand him. I've got a sort of P.G. Woodhouse, Jeeves and Worcester image, because that's, you know, 1950s. He probably takes high tea at 4 p.m. I
mean, yeah, that's a great point. We do have some film, not much, but some film from this moment in the late 50s and early 60s. And now you have me really wanting to dig a little bit deeper to see if I can find at least an audio recording of him giving a speech, because some of these characters have come alive through recordings. I can talk more about some really wonderful examples of that. But he would be the one I would be most interested to hear at this point.
Fascinating to wonder if he was just like an Englishman abroad in that period, just speaking louder in English so that the natives could understand, you know?
Yes.
So anyway, so Lord Parga was involved in the pacification or peace agreements back in 1957, I guess, 1958. And then what we have is, I understand from the book, for Colombians, conservative liberals, communists, the Creole peace, and I'm reading right from your book at the moment, involved a return to old occupations and once familiar lands. During the last months of 1958, a second round of desplazado repatriation commenced across an arc stretching from the northeastern highlands through Gran Tolima to the Valle del Cauca in the southwest. It's amazing. It's amazing this. It's almost... I don't say it, but it almost feels like a sort of a lightweight agrarian reform. They're allowed to go back to the lands. I don't know if I'm out of line saying that, because we have never had an agrarian reform. This in Colombia, the only Latin American country, I believe, to not have had an agrarian reform. And I met an academic the other day who's going to be working on this, but she said, well, you know, Colombia is the country of what's it called? Contracts and counter contracts. We plan to do these things and then we undo them. But what would you say about this, let's say, repatriation?
Right. So one of the things I try to do both in the book and some other articles that I have forthcoming is rethink this period we know as La Violencia in terms of displacement, as we were talking about in the first segment. So thinking about questions of property and sort of human mobility and what this means for, as you say, people's relationship to the land, but also sort of the quality of democratic citizenship. So you mentioned the Creole peace, which is my term to describe what happens in the late 1950s. As I also said in the first segment, a lot of what happens in Colombia around truth-telling and reconciliation looks like a little bit like what happens in, say, the Southern Cone countries in the 1980s, or Central America. But as opposed to that, there's no international precedent. There's no model for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in the 1950s. So I use this term Creole peace, Paz Criolla, to express sort of, you know, this homegrown element that the Colombians are making up these models as they go along. But what's really crucial, and I love your formulation that this is sort of a lightweight agrarian reform, is that these initiatives for peace are not just coming from elites like Lord Parga. They're not just coming from the Colombian state. You've got, I believe, tens of thousands of Colombians, rural Colombians, who in the late 50s take this moment of democratic optimism and potential peace as an opportunity to return home to the lands that they had had moved from because of the threat of violence. So in some ways, I hadn't quite connected it in precisely that way to the subject of agrarian reform, but you're right, sort of these, sort of the Juan Valdez, or the other figure I use in the book is this figure, Jose Dolores, sort of the archetypal Tolima peasant of the era that would have been a reference that would have been very familiar to people at the time. They're taking politics into their own hands.
Okay.
And moving back to the land. But very briefly, what's also happening at the state level in this time is we have a lot of programs designed to get desplazados, displaced rural peoples, back to their homes. Mm-hmm. So various land restitution programs. That's another very strong parallel between the 1950s, 1960s, and what's been happening in recent years. And it's not just the peace process with the FARC. We should say that there's longer policies that have been followed by the Santos administration in particular. Mm. So there's an eye, though, as the Colombian government is seeking to allow these desplazados to return and to generally rehabilitate the countryside in the late 1950s. They say, well, eventually we're going to get to a bigger agrarian reform project. Mm-hmm. It's going to cover the entire national territory, not just these central regions that have been hardest hit by violence. And this is sort of what got me into studying this in the first place, the developmental politics of the 1960s. Things like John F. Kennedy's Alliance for Progress, all this U.S. development aid, the sort of emphasis on agrarian reform and technical experts who are going to remake Latin America and other parts of the world. So there is a progression from these programs more centered on the aftermath of violence to an agrarian reform that's going to be a little more redistributionist in its striking more directly at the rural inequality than the programs of the 1950s. And Colombia is cited as a model for these, but as you say, it doesn't end up working out. Something I touch on a little bit in one of the later chapters of the book looks at 1960s reformism. But to cite an example, the economist Albert Hirschman knew Colombia very well, and he writes in the mid-1960s that the 1961 Colombian agrarian reform law is one of the country's finest hours. But that book that he publishes first comes out in 63, is reissued in 65. That's still the best study we have of agrarian reform in Colombia.
Incredible, isn't it?
It's really remarkable.
Especially when we think today about the problems of titillation and the problems of ownership and the problems of distribution and the problems of illicit crops and national parks and baldios. I mean, it's so complex now. What I liked a lot, of course, you study in some detail Manuel Marulanda or Tiro Fijo, or what's his other name? Pedro Antonio Marin. And I like the fact you dispel a little bit how history has him styled. And of course, he's the forefather of the FARC, or the father of the FARC, if you want to say, along with Jacobo Arenas and so on. But he's styled in history as a peasant. But as you say, his life better fit the mold of a backwards entrepreneur. Toiling in the soil interested him less than pasturing cattle on rented lands closer to the road. So, I mean, it's interesting. I don't know what to say. Is the evolution of a stereotype or evolution of this kind of legend around Marulanda? You do address this in there. Mm-hmm. He's definitely got a different image. He's traveled within his region. He knows what's going on. It's not just some. Because I would imagine through the 1960s and 1970s, it's much easier to portray him in the press as an ignorant campesino, who just wants redistribution. But really, he understood the plight of, let's say, the common man, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, in a lot of ways, he's representative. In earlier versions of the book, I didn't introduce him by the names we know him as. Manuel Marulanda, Tiro Fijo. As I write in the book now, he's, in a lot of ways, Colombia's most famous desplazado.
Yeah.
So as a young man in his, teens and early, late teens, early 20s, mid-20s, in the 1940s, 1950s, he's a classic paisa.
Yeah.
You know, he's from a family of coffee entrepreneurs in the region of Greater Caldas, of Viejo Caldas. And he's a petty merchant. He's selling wood, you know, doing sort of whatever he can do, but it's not necessarily farming.
Mm.
So he gets around a lot, and he's driven from these occupations, as I write in the book, sort of the mobility he had as a salesman sort of takes on a very dire dimension during the conservative government repression of the 40s and 50s. And that's later what drives him into the ranks of the Communist Party. It's not some sort of drive for power. It's this question of survival. And it's sort of, as you say, only later on that he takes on some of these mythic, these mythic dimensions. And his own sort of narration of this period is a great example of how the Creole piece of the late 1950s becomes the forgotten piece of my book's title. Mm-hmm. So if you look at his, the book that's presented is his memoir, which comes out, I can't remember, it's 1970s, 1980s, Cuadernos de Campaña, sort of, you know, field journals.
Mm.
It skips from 1953 to 1964.
Okay.
This whole period that I write about in the book is just absent. Because his willingness to sort of engage with the state, to return to sort of a more pacific form, peaceful form of just sort of, again, just sort of backcountry life as a backcountry entrepreneur. He, in the sort of the interests of presenting himself as a leader, founder of this revolutionary group, that period has to get pushed, that prior period of his life has to get pushed aside. But it's really wonderful. If you look at some of the interviews that he did in the mid-1980s in particular, you can really pick up his wistfulness for that prior era.
Interesting.
You know, an era where we thought that words would suffice and that arms would be unnecessary.
Mm.
So even sort of in his own layering of myth and sort of different memories of this period over subsequent decades, you can still pick up little hints of, I think, what he would have been feeling in the in the period of the late 50s and early 60s.
So this absence of 11 years, that's what your book slots in to fill a gap. It's perfect. Now, I think it's really fascinating to, as a journalist, as someone who studies words and so on, and the way things are written, the terminology used back in these days, and especially 1961, when it's the opponents of the communists talking of the independent republics, or las republiquetas independientes, and now we're seeing the same language being employed by one Alejandro Ordóñez in his sort of, let's say, pre-campaign speeches. And I just think there's a redundancy to this language today, or at least it's almost, I don't know. I just find using the same language from the 1960s to be so out of place.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I wrote about this in a blog post for the Monkey Cage, the Washington Post politics blog, back in October, just before the plebiscite. The term independent republic actually has an even deeper history.
Oh, really?
We have to think about it. These very long-running elite Colombians' concerns about how difficult it is to consolidate power in this country, and sort of this concerns about the fragmentation of sovereignty. So one of the first instances that I've been able to locate is this idea of this little republic that's somehow, you know, threatening to break Colombia apart or stands outside of the nation, even though it's within the national territory. Álvaro Gómez, who's a opposition conservative senator in 1961, is the one who famously introduces that phrase into Colombian political discourse. But his father, Laureano Gómez, who'd been president in the early 1950s and is really the major driver of both political polarization and state repression in the 40s and 50s, when he himself is getting a start as a young politician, young journalist in the 19-teens and 20s, he refers to the loss of Panama in the first years of the 20th century. He refers to Panama as a republiquilla, so this little republic that, you know, unjustly broke away from the country. So yeah, it, you know, it's stunning to think about the echoes or the direct direct borrowing of language today from 50 plus years ago, but it actually, it goes back almost a century. And it might even have sort of older origins than that.
Probably.
But that's something I'm hoping to explore in a new project, sort of these, some of these longer trends in Colombian political thought since the late 19th century.
They are one to bring them up, especially characters like Ordóñez. I find it very, very interesting indeed. And I think that brings us quite nicely forwards, and we can spend the last 8 or so minutes chatting a little bit about today's Colombia. And there is a question in your book there, and I think it's a question posed by Colombians, but of those of us who live there or spent much time there, we feel very, very close to the country. But it's that thing is, are we a violent country? And, well, there's no simple answer to it. I mean, if you were just to take it on figures and so on and so forth, I think the answer would be the one-word answer. But at the same time, it was a violent region as well. I mean, we're looking at issues in Peru, we're looking at issues in the Southern Cone, it was Brazil, etc. It's not as if the whole area has ever been completely, let's say, at peace. And so I think it's so interesting when you wrote, I guess it's the winding down of the book, is the future of peace in Colombia is far from assured. 3 decades of atrocities have left trust a scarce good in the public realm. Political negotiation will also neither unravel Colombia's convoluted system of land ownership nor put an end to the drug trade. And I think that's it, isn't it? I mean, I've been up here out of Colombia for a couple of days and, of course, talking to friends and so on and so forth. And they say, well, why don't they do this and why don't they do that? And it's something, of course, we have only just touched on in this chat, is that when you've got so much money tied into a drugs trade and, of course, illegal mining. And now I guess it's the transshipment of people smuggling as well through Colombia. It throws a spanner into everything. And that throws a spanner, of course, into any possible land reform as well, which, of course, is number one on the agenda in the agreed peace accords from Havana.
Right, right. And I think you've hit the nail right on the head that we have a narrative, and it's really the FARC's narrative of its own history, or the FARC's narrative of Colombian history through its own image, that we have these 50, you know, we're coming up on the 53rd anniversary of the FARC's founding about a month from now. If we look at levels of violence, they actually continue to go down after the period that I study. The FARC are really a peripherally and politically marginal group until the 1980s when drugs come on the scene. First with marijuana, and then it's less, you know, coca growing than it is cocaine processing and transshipment on its way to the U.S. as these cocaine circuits are being withdrawn in the 1970s and 1980s in South America. The nature of the conflict and the nature of the actors within the conflict changes really profoundly in the 1980s. So if you look at, the 2011 Victims Law passed by the Santos administration, it refers to 1985 as the beginning of the contemporary conflict. And if you look at a lot of the things that the Centro de Memoria Histórica, the Historical Memory Center, in these sort of semi-official reports has been writing, there's still a tension. You know, do we treat sort of the late 1950s or the 1940s as the start of the conflict? What is our mandate relative, or should we stick to our mandate of the past three plus decades? It's still sort of a tension that one can detect in there. And so drugs, you know, make a difference in an enormous number of ways. The amount of money involved, the amount of coordination that they encourage, so the displacement and dispossession of lands in the 1940s and 50s that I write about lack the sort of, maybe not centralized, but coordinated character that they've had with paramilitarism since the 1980s, and the sort of agrarian counter-reform that's in very large part tied to narco-paramilitary interests.
It's just fascinating, isn't it? And if I take, I think it might even be the last line of your book, it says, "Peace may indeed be a more difficult proposition in Colombia today, but the origins of contemporary democracy's challenges are not located solely in a past of violence. By examining the local, regional, and even national meanings of belonging and prosperity, present as well as past, the causes of violence and potential practices to counter it can be brought into our ongoing global conversations about peace and violence." And there you have it. I mean, that's really it. I mean, that is the last sentence in the book. Surely,
yeah, there's the last sentence.
So you almost got a drum roll as it goes in there. But it's true. There are so many things that need to be addressed. But sometimes I go through waves of euphoria in Colombia about what's going on, and then I hit pits of despair, especially. And so I would, in this last couple of minutes, how do you feel? How do you feel at this present time around what's going on?
Yeah. It's been a very difficult fall between, you know, politically between the US election and then the Colombian plebiscite before that.
And then for me, Brexit. I mean,
right. No, absolutely. Yeah. So this sort of, you know, this second half of 2016. I think just in the way that the peace process went over those last couple months of 2016, we've got a perfect microcosm of these great gyrations and feeling that we've been talking about. This, on the one hand, sort of the despair that followed with a lot of people felt after the peace process, the peace accord was rejected in early October. But then this capacity to go back to the negotiating table, and you know, some 6 weeks later, and really that was only like 11, 12 days of negotiation, the capacity to come back and come to a new accord. Arrive at a new accord. I think that speaks to the capacity for peace.
Yeah.
And the ways in which, you know, to get back to our prior point about just the Colombian distrust of the Colombian elite, just the way the government has handled the construction of the FARC demobilization zones. How did they not plan for this? You know, there are technical issues at play, but it's hard to walk away with an impression other than they just don't care.
Yeah.
Or they just hope it goes away. So there's an element of that. But on the other hand, the fact that as the government in particular, the FARC to a lesser extent, haven't been hitting their marks in, you know, this D-Day plus whatever number of days schedule, the accord hasn't fallen apart. And that the parties continue to maintain a commitment to seeing it through. And you know, I think international support through the United Nations, or you know, technical expertise, hopefully financial support, but you know, after the U.S. election, that's increasingly in question. Those are important supports for the peace process that didn't exist in the Creole peace of the 1950s, 60s.
I think you're completely right on that one. And of course, reference to, again, my trip to Guaviare, skeletal construction down there. And you're like, well, why was this not thought through or acted? It just felt like, well, you know, it's signed now. It's done. It felt like that a bit. It's like, it's over. But fascinating. And it's been a real, real pleasure to talk to you and meet you here online. But let's just let my listeners know where they can find your book. Should they be, well, of course, they should be interested, but should they be interested to get a hold of Forgotten Peace?
Yeah. So book just came out about a month ago with the University of California Press, and it's available on Amazon. It's available on the press's website. And I'm happy to announce that there's a Spanish translation in the works that will be coming out in Bogota. Probably early, by the beginning of next year, though very possibly earlier.
So you'll be down for next year's book fair.
I'm very much hoping. That's sort of my target goal would be to have it out by then.
That'd be excellent indeed, and I will pop along and meet you in person then when you're there promoting it. So let me take this moment to say thank you to you, Robert A. Carl, an assistant professor of history at the University of Princeton, talking to us about Colombia and indeed his book, Forgotten Peace. Thank you again, Robert.
Thank you, Richard.
You're most welcome. This has been episode 184 of Columbia Calling. I've been Richard McCall. I know you've enjoyed this series of shows that we've had recently. Please continue to listen as we have interesting people lined up week in, week out, discussing all to do with Columbia. So that's me signing off for today for Columbia Calling. Thank you again for listening. Bye-bye.